I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Did I say health care? I meant tax breaks. Today, President Obama rolled out new initiatives meant to demonstrate that the White House sympathizes with a frustrated middle class. The proposals are said to be a preview of the president's State of the Union address this Wednesday. Among them, a doubling of the child care tax credit for families earning under $85,000, with families making under $115,000 also seeing some increase in their tax credit. The president is also proposing $1.6 billion increase in federal funding for child care programs, and he would require large employers to enroll employees in work-based retirement programs or, if those aren't available, in direct deposit retirement accounts, giving employers tax credits for doing so and leaving it up to the employees to opt out. The proposals come from the Middle Class Task Force, headed up by Vice President Joe Biden, but they're being released as the White House responds to the loss of the Democrats' supermajority in the Senate, with last week's win by Massachusetts Republican Scott Brown. Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News and author of the network's blog, The Note. Rick Klein, what is the message the president's trying to get across?
He's trying to tee up a message that he cares about the middle class. And we're talking about new tax credits. We're talking about some caps on loan payments, some expanded savings initiatives, caregiver grants that would allow people to more easily take care of loved ones and relatives. It's all packaged together as part of a new economic message that the White House is trying to roll out as part of the State of the Union to say, look, we get it. We're on your side. We're doing our best. They realize that people aren't seeing the kind of results that they'd like out of the economy, and they're doing their best to try to tout what's out there already and have some new meat to put on the bones.
You're being told that a phrase that they're using, which has been around for a decade now, is the sandwich generation.
That's right. Folks that really feel like they're not poor enough to be stuck on big government programs, and they're certainly by not any stretch of the imagination rich. In other eras, there were other ways to talk about this group, but it's been an elusive group. A lot of them are political independents without big affiliations, and they're folks that powered President Obama to victory, and that according to polls and according to the election results in Massachusetts and also New Jersey and Virginia have not been still on board with Democrats.
Well, let's take a quick look at the Massachusetts race, because over the weekend we learned a lot more about it, and not in any way to discount the voter anger here that was expressed at the polls and propelled Scott Brown. But according to the New York Times, all of that was organized by Tea Party movement groups that quietly established a beachhead here in Massachusetts, came in from outside the state. And Brown pollster Neil Newhouse acknowledged on CNN yesterday that the Republican Party kept that and Brown's progress a secret because they didn't want to tip off the Democrats. Media critic Howard Kurtz weighed in as well, slamming the press for not picking up on all of this, the out-of-state interaction. But is that kind of a plan, that sort of, it's being called the stealth campaign, is that going to be possible from here on out, outside of the state organizing without people noticing?
Boy, it's hard to imagine that any party is going to be caught off guard again, given what we learned in Massachusetts. I mean, I think this is also, a lot of this is Monday morning quarterbacking. I mean, Republicans were caught off guard, in all honesty, by this as well. They didn't see what was happening until it was so big that they kind of jumped on. They weren't really returning phone calls for a long time for the national side, but they're doing it now. And what's going to happen, I think, is there will be places where this flares up, sometimes in Republican primaries, sometimes in general elections. But it's unlikely to have the same kind of focus that we saw in this particular race. And I think it's going to be hard to bottle that energy and that enthusiasm, keep it going for either political party. Clearly, Scott Brown benefited from a number of forces, not least of which was this sense of him being the 41st vote to hold up the Obama agenda. But I don't know that it's something that you can replicate in every state.
But Republicans are being targeted by this movement as well. You spoke with Senator John Cornyn this weekend. He chairs the National Republican Senatorial Committee. What did he have to say to you?
He said that he's expecting more Republicans to jump in. Sometimes that means more people jumping up in a competitive primary. He's got one primary in particular that's very hot down in Florida, where the national folks are supporting Governor Charlie Crist, the popular moderate governor and former House Speaker down there. Marco Rubio is got the conservative and the Tea Party folks on board, and he may very well win that race. There's plenty of problems among Republicans and a lot of angst and anxiety still being directed at party leadership in Washington. This is going to be a dangerous time for incumbents of either party. Right. It doesn't really matter your ideology or your party label. This is going to be a very tough year.
And what about people getting comfortable with the furniture in the White House? Just a quick thought on that. Last week when President Obama proposed his new rules to limit the size of big banks standing standing next to him was former Treasury Secretary Paul Volcker, who'd been arguing for more regulation of Wall Street. He right there up front, more back in the shadows, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner and Economic Advisor Larry Summers. Are we seeing a shift there?
There's a lot of talk about potential shakeups. It doesn't look, though, that likely that Tim Geithner, Larry Summers would be out in the near future. Ben Bernanke, the Fed chairman, had a very tough couple of days, and it looked on Friday like his vote, his confirmation was in the balance all of a sudden. But it looks like the White House has successfully stabilized that ship. There's so much anger out there, and I think senators and who are reassessing their political stances on things like this in light of what happened in Massachusetts. People want change. They don't like the status quo. They don't like the status of the economy and the TARP and the bailouts. So all of this is very much in flux. But this is not a White House that is likely to do house cleanings. This is a pretty secure bunch, and they feel good about where things stand, even though this has been clearly a series of pretty bad setbacks.
Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News and author of the network's blog, The Note. Thank you, as always.
Thank you.
Well, officials from around the world are meeting in Montreal today to come up with a better way of coordinating relief efforts in Haiti. Some aid groups complain that the U.S. initially did a poor job of running the Port-au-Prince airport, slowing down distribution. Today, Haiti's prime minister said his government is now capable of leading the rebuilding efforts. Really? Much of the aid that's come into Haiti has passed through its neighbor to the east, the Dominican Republic. Both nations share the island of Hispaniola, but Haiti has one-fifth the number of employed workers, one-sixth the miles of paved roads, 1/24th the amount of electricity. Haiti's infant mortality rate is 2.5 times that in the Dominican Republic. Haiti has 5 times the number of malnourished children and 11 times the cases of AIDS. But at one point in history, Haiti was the richer nation, so what happened? And where does Haiti go from here? Jared Diamond won a Pulitzer Prize for his groundbreaking 1998 book, Guns, Germs, and Steel. It was about the rise and fall of civilization. Now he's co-editor of the new book, Natural Experiments of History. It has a chapter comparing Haiti and the Dominican Republic. Jared, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you. It's good to be with you again.
And many people now have seen again that aerial shot of Haiti sticking like the toe out of a boot on the island of Hispaniola, with the Dominican Republic more the heel of the boot and the length of the boot. And remind us what you immediately notice when you look down at that.
It's an amazing border. If you fly over at 31,000 feet, for example, on the flight from Miami to Santo Domingo, and you look down, there's a sharp line. One side of the line is brown. The other side of the line is green. The west side of the line, the brown one, is the deforested, muddy, eroded fields of Haiti. And the east side of the line, the green one, is the Dominican Republic with its pine forests. Two countries sharing the same island with very different histories, partly for environmental reasons, but mainly because of accidents of colonial history and their consequences.
Well, let's start there. They both, as you said, have colonial histories. The Dominican Republic colonized by the Spanish, the French took Haiti, but then there was a distinct difference. Explain.
Sure. A big difference developed in the 1700s. By the 1700s, France was rich, Spain was getting poor. Spain had other colonies in the New World, Mexico and Peru and Bolivia, that it cared more about. Whereas for France, France invested lots of money bringing slaves from Africa into Haiti to develop sugar plantation agriculture, with the result that Haiti became France's richest colony and the source of something like half of France's foreign exchange. But it also meant that Haiti had a population of about 85% African slaves, while in the east, what became the Dominican Republic under Spain, few slaves were brought in. It remained much poorer, but Spanish was the language rather than Creole in the west.
Well, the Creole-speaking Haitians are very proud of their history. They led a slave revolt, taking over the island in, I believe, 1803. And by the way, we're reminded Pat Robinson here in the U.S., the Christian evangelical, blamed this earthquake on that slave revolt. But what happened after that started the country's decline?
after the slave revolt in 1803 or 1804, the slaves, having thrown out the French in a really bloody war in which the French behaved treacherously, naturally the last thing that the Haitians wanted was for Europeans to come back. And so the Haitians were not interested in European immigration or investment. Haiti was very rich. Dominican Republic was poor. Haiti probably took over the Dominican Republic and stayed there for 20 years until they were pushed out or moved out. And over the course then of the 1800s, the United States and Europe invested in and traded with the Dominican Republic, but the U.S. and Europe did not want to see a former slave state succeed. On the other hand, the Haitians themselves did not want to have whites interfering with them again. And so Haiti received less investment immigration. Gradually, its economy wound down, while the economy of the Dominican Republic wound up to the point where today the Dominican Republic, formerly the poor part, is six times richer.
Well, isolating Haiti further is the fact you mentioned earlier that they spoke this Creole that today only Haitians living in the diaspora here in the U.S. speak the same form of Creole?
That's true. There may be some other French settlers on Caribbean islands that can understand Haitian Creole, but basically it's a language for Haiti, whereas the Dominicans speak Spanish, one of the major international languages. And, of course, that positions them well for foreign trade, whereas in Haiti the elite speak French, but the elite is cut off by language from the mass of the Haitian people.
Right.
And that, of course, is a modern problem in Haiti.
Well, let's get us back to our timeline then. You have Haiti sort of in a spiral towards poverty as other countries won't trade with this new country born of a slave revolt, as you said. How did Haiti then further devolve?
The next step is sometime early in the 1900s, the Dominican Republic caught up to Haiti economically. And then in the 1920s and 1930s, both countries had horrible dictators, perhaps the two worst dictators in New World history, but they were very different. The dictator of the Dominican Republic, a guy called Trujillo, was interested in becoming rich himself, and so he developed business in the Dominican Republic, but he owned the businesses himself. He developed an airline, chocolate, forestry business. He even took a cut of the prostitutes. Whereas in the Haitian side, the dictator Duvalier was not interested in building up the economy. So under that evil dictator, the Dominican Republic developed further and Haiti developed less.
Well, it seems sort of obvious. We know so much now about Papa Doc Duvalier, but why didn't he want to build up the economy? Trujillo, as you said, built up the Dominican economy for himself so that he could skim off these businesses. But was Duvalier just happy to pillage the country as much as he could?
That's an interesting question. Partly it's differences between individuals, but I think partly also Trujillo reflected the Dominican Republic and Duvalier reflected Haiti. That's to say, Trujillo had the Dominican interest in outside trade and developing businesses, whereas Duvalier inherited the mantle of a nation that had become isolated.
That's civilization expert Jared Diamond. By the way, he just mentioned how countries didn't want to trade with Haiti after its slave revolt. Haitian-American Francis Latour, writing this weekend, reminds us that it was Thomas Jefferson who helped impose that trade embargo to discourage American slaves from rising up. We'll have more with Jared. Also later in the show, Musical Diplomats. Back in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Jared Diamond, an expert on the rise and fall of civilizations, taking us through the stark differences between Haiti and its island neighbor, the Dominican Republic. Before the break, the impact of two dictators, Rafael Trujillo of the Dominican Republic and Papa Doc Duvalier of Haiti. And Jared Diamond, you mentioned that the deforestation of Haiti started during the French colonial period when the French would bring ships filled with slaves to Haiti and then fill those ships with timber bound for France. And that deforestation continued under Duvalier?
That's true. In addition, there's the slight environmental difference that we mentioned at the beginning, that the Haitian side is steeper and a little drier and has thinner soils. So when you cut down trees on the Haitian side, the forest regrows more slowly. In addition, Haitians depend for fuel on charcoal, which they make by cutting out down trees. All that meant that the Haitian side got deforested more than the Dominican side. And finally, under Trujillo, since he wanted to make money, one of the ways he wanted to do it was by forest exports, but he expected to be in power for a long time, so he got in Swedish foresters to tell them how to manage his forest very well, and he made sure that nobody else chopped down Dominican trees except for him, Trujillo. Mm-hmm. So he contributed, this evil guy, to the preservation of the Dominican forest.
Well, you say Trujillo, by the way. We say Trujillo, and just a slightly different ways of speaking the same Dominican word. Rafael Trujillo was a dictator from 1930 to 1961. Papa Doc reigned from 1957 to 71. But they moved from a dictatorship to elected leadership. Take us through that.
Sure. First of all, I have to apologize for my Argentinian pronunciation.
That's all right.
of Trujillo instead of Trujillo.
That's right.
So after Trujillo was assassinated, perhaps with CIA help, there was then a series of more or less democratically elected governments in the Dominican Republic. And the first president, who was then reelected with fraudulent help successive times, was Trujillo's chief of staff, Balaguer, who is a complicated person. He did participate in some of the massacres and torturing in the Dominican Republic. He nevertheless got democratically elected, although some of the elections were tainted with fraud. And most surprising to us is that he appears to have been a passionate environmentalist. So some Dominicans complained to him, you want to make 30% of the Dominican Republic a national park. Isn't that terrible? And Balaguer said, no, I would like to make the whole country a national park. So Balaguer contributed to the preservation of the Dominican environment, to the point where, with all these forests, the Dominican Republic has great hydroelectric potential and generates a lot of its electricity from its stands of forests, which produce rain and water.
So it sounds like you're saying even after the dictatorships were brought down in both countries, the governments had spotty records and included periods of American military intervention. So bring us up to date. Rate the democracies in more recent years.
Both countries are struggling democracies. In the Dominican Republic, the democracy, I would say, is a functional democracy. In the recent elections for the last decade in the Dominican Republic, the president has almost always been defeated in the election and has always gracefully retired from power. So that's a real sign for a successful democracy. The Haitian elections, on the other hand, have been marred by various unrests and denials of the results of the election.
And why is that?
Long history, the state of the population, the higher level of education in the Dominican Republic. In Haiti, the break between the upper classes, the 10 to 15% of the French-speaking wealthy mulattoes, and on the other hand, the 85% of the Creole-speaking slave population, so that the Dominican government, the leaders of the government, are less distanced from and more identified with the population that they govern than in Haiti.
Where do you see, Jared Diamond, where do you see Haiti recovering now after the earthquake?
That's a good question. Maybe, hopefully, the earthquake will galvanize the attention of outsiders. The solution is going to have to consist of two things. On the one hand, Haiti is so poor that it lacks the economic resources to pull itself up, even if the population government were completely motivated to pull themselves up. So yes, help is going to be needed, help from the United States, help from France, help from the Dominican Republic. On the other hand, the Haitians are also going to have to organize themselves. So the future for Haiti is going to depend upon the elite of Haiti deciding for itself that it's going to make its best efforts on behalf of the rest of the population and not merely enrich itself on the backs of the population as it has done for 200 years. Without that reconciliation within Haiti, foreign aid is just going to be a bandage, not a solution.
Recently, NPR's Daniel Shore floated the idea in a commentary of turning Haiti into something of a UN protectorate, the same way the West did with some countries after World War II and more recently in Bosnia and Kosovo after wars there. To have some independent administration of the country. First of all, your thoughts, knowing the Haitian history, would they consider that a form of imperialism, and your sense of if it might work?
My thoughts, if one says turn Haiti into a UN protectorate, as a grammarian, I'm looking for the subject of that sentence. Who is going to turn Haiti into a UN protectorate? The only people who can do that are the Haitians. These are a proud people. Justifiably, they're proud. They threw out the French. They maintain themselves as the first independent slave state. The last thing that they're going to do is to throw away their national identity and give themselves over to anyone. Haiti, like any country in the world, is going to have to govern itself. The best we can hope is that the Dominican Republic, in its own enlightened self-interest, will realize that it's sharing an island with another desperately poor country that is sending so many undocumented laborers into the Dominican Republic, and perhaps the long-term interests of the Dominican Republic will best be served by joining the United Nations and other agencies in helping their island partner.
Jared Diamond, professor of geography at the University of California, Los Angeles, co-editor of the new book, Natural Experiments of History. Thanks so much.
You are welcome.
Okay, quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, texting within families. Some parents say it's the best way to communicate with their kids, even when everyone is in the same house. And one therapist agrees. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, the census starts today, and given the economy, will it be hard to find those people in foreclosure, for instance? That's later. The latest news is next, Here and Now. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he believes Israel will retain parts of the West Bank forever. Netanyahu made the comment shortly after meeting with U.S. Mideast envoy George Mitchell, who's been pressing Israel to stop settlement activity in the West Bank. At a tree planting ceremony at a settlement outside of Jerusalem, Netanyahu said this place will be an inseparable part of the state of Israel forever. But what about Gaza, the other Palestinian territory? Last year at this time, an Israeli offensive inside Gaza was just coming to an end. Israeli forces were attempting to stop Hamas from firing rockets into Israel. Rocket attacks are now down, but Israel continues to pressure Gaza with an economic blockade. The BBC's Edward Sturton reports on the results.
Walking around Gaza after being in Israel, you very quickly realize you've dropped several divisions in the economic league table. No more smooth Israeli tarmac and smart cars here. Really quite a startling amount of the traffic is accounted for by donkeys and carts. You can still see the physical scars of last year's war. The pile of rubble on my right by the sea used to be the presidential palace. They're still tidying it up and they haven't managed to rebuild it because they can't get the materials through the Israeli blockade. The main employers' organisation, the Palestinian Federation of Industries, says that because of the blockade, 70% of established businesses have been more or less forced to a standstill. The tunnel economy has taken over. Amra Hamad, the Federation's Deputy Secretary General, has coined a new term.
Tunnelmen. We have been replacing the businessmen terminology with the tunnelmen. They are making millions of dollars. They are replacing actually the legitimate businessmen.
I climbed up to a vantage point just outside the town of Sderot, which was very much at the centre of things during the war here a year ago. This, of course, was the main target for rockets coming out of Gaza.
Israel withdrew from Gaza in the summer 2005 with hopes for peace.
Marcus Sheff is the executive director of the Israel Project, which promotes Israel's case in the international press.
Of course, Hamas took over here and they spent all their creative energy on working out how to kill Israelis on this side of the border, instead of working out how to help their own people. This is, of course, the tragedy of the disaster that is Gaza. And compare that to what's happening in the West Bank at the moment, where the Palestinian Authority, together with the Israelis, are building a true civil society where life is so much better.
These are the production lines. We do toffees, we do chewing gum. These are new lines.
This is the biggest family business on the West Bank, with a turnover of some $40 million a year. It makes sweets and biscuits for the local and international market, produces animal feed and has tourism interests too. The owner and chief executive, Mazen Sunokra, says they have indeed seen things improve.
We are having more of donors' money coming into the Palestinian territories, more of supporting our Palestinian budget vis-a-vis having a better stability in the public sector, at least paying salaries on time, having a little bit also more projects coming in from the donor countries and agencies. There was a little bit of change on dismantling some of the checkpoints, or at least softening the restrictions on some of the checkpoints, but this is very minor. We are losing completely Gaza. We are losing completely Jerusalem East. So the gain, the small gain that you are having in the West Bank, you are losing a greater majority by not being able to trade in Gaza or Jerusalem East.
At the last election campaign, Israel's Likud party said they plan to focus on prosperity in the West Bank in the hope that that would build support for the Fatah-controlled Palestinian Authority, which is much more to their taste than Hamas. I asked the PA's economy minister, Hassan Abu Libde, whether that strategy is working.
By imposing the siege, they basically allowed Hamas to have its own economy and to have a lifeline, which enabled them very recently to establish their own budget and announce it. So Israel cannot say that they are really inflicting on Hamas. They are inflicting on the Palestinian citizens of Gaza, and I believe they are directly and indirectly allowing for Hamas to strengthen its grip on Gaza and strengthen its ability to establish its own economic regime.
So if Israel's strategy is to use economic measures to strangle Hamas and to bolster the Palestinian Authority, it isn't working?
Not at all. In fact, to the contrary. It's working in favor of Hamas.
That report from the BBC's Edward Sturton in Gaza. Just ahead, trying to avoid a lumpy census. And what's in it for you? That's in 30 seconds here and now. Sled dog teams driven by school children will greet the U.S. Census Bureau director in the remote Alaskan village of Norvik today as the 2010 U.S. Census formally kicks off. The census often does headcounts in isolated places like Norvik. People in the rest of the country simply fill in census forms, which will be mailed out in mid-March, and census takers follow up with residents who don't respond. Because money and power are at stake, the census helps determine how many elected officials each state has and how much federal money it receives. There are people who want to boycott this year, such as political conservatives and Latino preachers who are pushing for immigration reform. Others are upset about the Census Bureau's decision to give African Americans the option of identifying themselves as Negro on the forms, something African Americans asked for, or count same-sex couples for the first time. And this go-around, counting people who used to live in foreclosed homes is also going to be a challenge. Joining us from New York is Ken Pruitt. He was Census Bureau director from 1998 to 2001. He now teaches about the census and public policy at Columbia University. He was a candidate to lead the census under President Obama. Ken, welcome.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And first of all, remind us, what does hang in the balance? What is the census for?
It's the starting point of how we run competitive elections, which means it's the starting point of how we run representative democracy.
Well, and we understand this year, states in the Northeast and Midwest are expected to lose some federal funding and maybe some congressional seats because more people are moving to the South and the West. So the census is very important. And by the way, your sense of the degree of difficulty this year?
Every census is difficult. I think this one is in an environment which is going to produce, if not more difficult challenges, certainly unexpected or a different set of challenges, and it will be very difficult to get a full count of the population.
Well, throw out one of those challenges.
Well, certainly the leading one is the estimate is there are 12 million undocumented workers in the United States, workers and their families. For all kinds of reasons, they're going to be very difficult to count, partly because they're going to not particularly want to be counted. They may fear that the census would be used somehow against them.
Well, and by the way, remind us, is it completely anonymous? I mean, when you fill out the form, do you say your name?
Yes, you do say your name. We already have the address, of course, but we don't have your name until you fill out the form. We ask the name for quality control purposes because we go back and revisit a number of households to make sure that we got the right form. We also ask the name because these forms actually are then put in the National Archives in case families 72 years later want to go back and get their ancestors' census records.
But are people asked if they're undocumented?
Oh, of course not.
Yeah.
We don't even ask if you're a citizen. The approximate population is in the country is 300 million, and 12 million are undocumented, and we don't include them in the census. That means we have a census undercount of 4% before we even start. And that's not the only group which is difficult to count. Renters are hard to count. People are highly mobile. People who do not have telephones, who are sort of socially isolated. People who are angry at the government, and that may be a large number this year, may simply say, I don't want to do it. You miss different groups at different rates, and you different parts of the country at different rates. Therefore, you get a lumpy census, and a lumpy census is unfair when it comes to allocating money and allocating political representation.
Just the words lumpy census together is kind of funny, but I get what you mean. It's not even.
What the census provides is a very complicated statistical portrait of the nature of our society, and businesses need that. Government needs that. Individual citizens, I would think, would like to know who are we and
right.
Where are we growing?
Well, let's just address some of the other challenges that have been pointed out, some of them smaller than others. But this past summer, Minnesota Republican Michelle Bachmann urged her constituents not to fill in the census. This was at the height of the concern about the activist group ACORN, who at one point had gone around as census takers. But they're not even going to be involved in actually taking the census this year. And so if she's encouraging her constituents not to entirely fill in the census, isn't she sort of maybe harming her own chances of keeping her seat?
Well, anything that sort of suggests that you should not cooperate with the Census Bureau depresses cooperation rates. And a congresswoman who's sort of being very negative about the census is not doing herself or her state a favor. What is it that she feels is intrusive about 10 simple questions that take 10 minutes to fill out?
Well, and how much of a problem do you think foreclosed homes are going to be?
They're a particular problem because a lot of people who have been foreclosed and are maybe temporarily relocating, maybe one of the parents is out trying to find a job someplace and another parent has got the child and they're living with in-laws. A family like that will wish it could be counted as what it saw itself as being, was a unified family living in a house and in a given place. And especially if they're being told by their own political leaders back home, count yourself as if you were here, is an impossibility, and it will really mess up the census. It's like asking the Katrina people who've left and gone to Houston, count yourself as if you're
right.
still in New Orleans.
Right.
The Census Bureau can't accommodate that.
Well, who else do you have trouble counting, and what's the cost of not counting them?
You know, the very rich who live in gated communities and with doormen and so forth, they don't want to be bothered. That's one of the population groups which people don't think about as being difficult to count. We mail out the form. We hope it gets mailed back in. If it gets mailed back in, we have a great census. If everybody mails it back in, all 120 million households, that doesn't happen. The mailback rate is in the, say, mid-60s. For every percentage, every 1% that is not returned is $88 million. That's what it costs us to go out and find that next percent. So that's too bad.
What's the penalty? What's the fee if you ultimately don't respond?
Oh, there's no penalty. It is mandatory, but we're not going to put someone in jail or fine them.
Well, we know how politically fraught the census can be. There was the 2003 fight in Texas over two new congressional seats that had to be created as a result of the census, and Democrats fled across state lines to a Holiday Inn because they felt Republicans were improperly doing that. Republicans have criticized President Obama for taking a great supervisory role over this census. And the Supreme Court had to weigh in on the census in 1999. You were Census Bureau Director. Bill Clinton wanted to take a sample count. The Supreme Court ruled he couldn't. That was considered a Republican victory. But you agree with Clinton. You've said that it can be statistically correct, even if you don't count every single person?
You can't be against sampling. I ask people who say they don't believe in sampling, they don't like it. I say, well, the next time you go to the doctor for a blood test, tell him to take it all out. My concern is that the census this time, the decennial census, is going to be in the neighborhood of $14 to $15 billion. That's twice what we spent in 2000. That, in turn, in 2000 was twice what we spent in 1990. But I think you could get an accurate census with a combination of the direct enumeration and some sort of sampling at a much lower cost and a high level of accuracy. And it's too bad the country can't debate it, but it's become such a poison topic that you can't even put it on the table.
Ken Pruitt, as we said, directed the Bureau from 1998 to 2001. He now teaches about the census and public policy at Columbia University. Ken, thanks so much.
Surely, my pleasure.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back.
I try to go outside just to step out for a few
That's the Portland, Oregon-based band The Student Loan. They return in December from a month-long tour of Cyprus, Algeria, Yemen. Yes, Yemen. Not high on most bluegrass band itineraries, but Student Loan is part of the Musical Overtures Tour, run by the State Department and the nonprofit Jazz at Lincoln Center. It started in 2005, and since then musicians have traveled to nearly 100 countries, many with strained relations with the U.S. So what did Student Loan learn in Yemen? Joining us from KOPB in Portland is Liz Chibukas, who sings and plays guitar and violin for the Student Loan. Liz, welcome.
Hi, thanks.
Also, Mark Girolami, who plays banjo and guitar and also sings. Mark, welcome to you as well.
Hi, nice to be here.
Well, as we said, you came back from Yemen in December before the Christmas Day bomb suspect who reportedly was trained there. But Yemen was already known as a terrorist haven. The USS Cole attack occurred in Yemen in 2000. So, Liz, were you concerned when you heard Yemen was one of the countries you'd go to?
There were definitely concerns. There were, you know, discussions with family members, but I never really thought for one second that I wouldn't go.
Well, so staying with you, Liz, your first performance in Yemen is at the Yemeni American Language Institute. Who's in the audience and what happened?
There were men and women, and what happened was we had a party there.
Yeah,
that
was
a great concert.
Let's take a listen to one of the songs you played in Yemen, Don't Bring Me Down.
Well, don't bring me down. Well, don't bring me down.
You know, a couple of the guys there started dancing and almost doing like traditional type Yemeni dances to bluegrass, which got everybody kind of hooting and hollering. And at one point, somebody ran into the school and came out with two cowboy hats. While we were playing, this kid ran up on stage to us and put them on myself and the mandolin player's head.
Liz, I understand somebody also took the microphone.
Yes, this first dancer, he came up to me in between songs and he said, "Can I borrow the microphone for a minute?" And I said, "Sure." And he grabs the microphone and he says, "Now, this is an American band, it's a Western band, and we should have a truly Western experience. Ladies, you really need to get up and dance." He was actually encouraging the women there to dance and have a good time, which we were not expecting.
Well, the Yemeni constitution gives equal rights to all, but there's a big education gap. Girls as young as 9 are forced into marriage. Women don't have power in their families. And dancing would normally be seen as inappropriate with men around. So what did the women do when they were asked to dance?
It looked like they were flattered, but they weren't going to take them up on the offer.
You know, maybe they didn't get up to dance, but you were part of a moment where at least they were encouraged to.
No, that felt great. And I got in the middle and danced too, which looked like it might have shocked a few people. But yeah, we're there to show what Americans are like and what our culture is like.
And we do a lot of workshops too and work with local musicians. You know, it's interesting, especially with Facebook and things like that now,
right,
how much these people do stay in touch with us.
And I understand some Yemeni musicians taught you their songs. Here you are practicing one with them. And so, Liz Chibukas from The Student Loan, how did Yemenis in the audience respond when they hear you play one of their songs?
It was an instant reaction of like, wow, they're actually trying something of ours, and they recognized the song and they were singing along and clapping.
Yeah, cheers and clapping and screaming and very ecstatic.
And a big reaction as well to a cover of Bob Dylan's I Shall Be Released. What did people say to you?
You know, they understand that it's protest music on some level. We did have one or two kind of mention that it applied to current events. You know, I think at that point, most of the tension in Yemen before this Christmas bombing and stuff, most of the tension centered around the Gitmo, the number of Yemeni detainees that we have there.
Well, I'm thinking, too, that it's interesting that you were singing I Shall Be Released, and on the Yemenis' mind is the Guantanamo Bay detainees.
Right.
It's on Americans' minds, too, because some of the Yemeni detainees who were released first to Saudi Arabia to a rehab program then ultimately made their way back to Yemen and are working with Al-Qaeda.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it's a tangled topic and Bob Dylan in the middle of it.
Right.
Yeah. You said you keep in touch with some people on Facebook or they do with you. Have people said anything to you subsequently after all these headlines?
A lot of people want us to come back, and we would love to do that.
Yeah, I'm not sure from the Yemeni perspective how much worse things are right now than they were.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there was There's been kind of this social unrest in the South that's caused violence. There's been clashes on the Saudi border. So I think for most people in their day-to-day lives, they're very concerned about it. But I don't know if things have really escalated in most people's minds.
Well, the program that you're part of has a lot of history. Jazz musician Dizzy Gillespie was an early participant. He was referred to as the U.S.'s secret sonic weapon when he traveled around Europe, the Middle East, and South Asia on the State Department's first Goodwill Jazz Tour. That was in 1956. Did you worry at all about being used, you know, used as a front for U.S. foreign policy?
Yes.
Absolutely.
It's a complicated issue internally because clearly there is that purpose. The State Department isn't doing this just out of the goodness of their hearts. You know, when we were in Burma, for example, on our previous tour, it was right after some big storm, and it was like the first time they'd accepted aid from the West. That was very heavy on creating good relations to try to get more interactions with their government. And at the same time, we teach a lot of students. We play for thousands of people who are very entertained and learn something. So I think we sort of take it, at least I take it, for those positive experiences.
Yeah, I came to the conclusion that even if I don't agree with every policy our government has, I'm proud of our country, and I want people to see a good side of it. And on the same token, I want to meet other people and have that human-to-human contact that is so much better and more efficient at doing what we really want to do with other countries than, say, occupying, or the diplomacy is always the better way to go.
Well, and so now you're musical diplomats, and it sounds like, you know, some heavy questions and observations, but also a lot of fun at times. A song that was apparently popular everywhere was your Mustache of Justice.
He's got that mustache of justice, got a nightstick at his side. Just do what Deputy Joe says if you want to get out of here alive.
Mark, just what is this about?
I had a friend growing up, Joe, and he had a very, very large Fu Manchu, sort of a biker look. And he got a job as a corrections officer in upstate New York. And so he had to trim his mustache down to what he referred to lovingly as his mustache of justice. And I just thought that phrase was hilarious. So I decided to write a song basically from the perspective of what if I had gotten arrested and thrown in the jail and Joe was my prison guard. What's been really humorous, though, is we've gone around the world. Turns out in police forces and prisons and militaries around the world, the mustache is a very universal look. So in all these other cultures, they actually get this mustache of justice joke or reference about this prison guard.
Well, that's Mark Girolami, and we've also been speaking with Liz Chabukas, members of the band The Student Loan, who traveled the world as part of a State Department program that tries to engage countries through music. But they've been speaking to us from Oregon, and we will listen to more of Mustache of Justice as we say thank you very much and good luck on the tour.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, he's an ex-mafioso garbage man, and he runs Pod 6 with an iron hand. Play you the fiddle or spin you a yarn. He's not in jail, he's probably working on his farm. He's got that Mustache of Justice, the nightstick at his side. Just do what Deputy Joe says if you want to get out of here.